This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bored of too many ads and dull, meaningless chat? We've got neither. Joy Drive, smart, fun radio.
With nearly two-thirds of Australian agricultural production benefiting from bee pollination, there's no doubt that bees play a significant role in the agricultural process. However, did you know that bees not only help ensure our food security, but also assist in monitoring contamination in our urban environment? And here to chat to us about two new studies about this is the Chief Environmental Scientist for EPA Victoria, Mark Taylor. Welcome back to Drive.
Yeah, good evening. How are you? Thanks for inviting me to talk about bees.
It's great to have you on. Mark, tell us a little about these studies. What do bees do to help us monitor contamination?
Well, first of all, to help the listeners, you can read the summary story in the conversation. We have an article there that sort of captures the overall findings from these two studies. So we undertook two studies. One was in Sydney, where we looked at legacy trace metals like lead, zinc, copper, for example, associated with industrial activity and urban activity, and also antimicrobial resistance. And then we did a second study in New Caledonia, in the capital city, Noumea, where most people probably don't realise, but there's a really long-term, historic, still ongoing nickel smelter there. It's been operating for over 100 years. And there we looked at the uptake of nickel, and along with other elements, in bees and honey. And it's fascinating stuff, because bees are pretty much everywhere, and we wanted to understand, can we use them to monitor pollution in the environment, as you use them as sentinel species?
And you can, by the sounds of it.
You can, absolutely. We use bees, and the Department of Agriculture uses bees all over the country to look for pests and diseases. And what we showed is that the bees accumulate the contaminants inside their body, and it's really clear that the closer they are to the source of the pollution, the greater the concentrations are in those bees. And moreover, it's greater in dead bees than live bees. We were able to demonstrate with other pieces of work during the study that the bees accumulate the contaminants as they age, but they don't pass it on to the queen bee, nor do they pass it through to the honey in any significant amount, which is interesting. And it means, therefore, sampling the dead bees is really useful. They're a much better proxy for environmental pollution. And the good news, if you like, for the study is that the honey's still good to eat, even in a place like Noumea, where in close to the nickel smelter, because it doesn't really leave the bees and get into the honey. The concentrations are still pretty low. So that's a good outcome.
It's almost like they're acting in some ways like, I suppose, a filter, aren't they? They're as much as they're being sentinels, they're also, on a small scale, I suppose, removing it, aren't they, that contaminant? And then, like you said, it's not going through to the honey.
That's correct. They effectively, it goes into the bees, into the honey stomach, and doesn't come out again. And so they're a barrier between environmental contamination and what we might then find in the honey. So it's a really good outcome. I think the other important finding is, from a research perspective and also from, you know, EPA's perspective of understanding and understanding contaminants in the environment and using bees for surveillance, bees provide an average of pollution around their hives. They forage about 2.5 kilometres on average from their hives. They will go shorter and longer distances depending on food, but they provide an average. So if you're using bees from a hive, that's much easier to get an average assessment of contaminants in that immediate environment than it is to go and do sampling, whether you do water sampling, dust sampling, or soil sampling, which would mean you have to do many more samples than just go to a single beehive and go, I'll get some bees, or collect the dead bees and be done with it. So in that way, it's a much more simple process, much more elegant process, and it allows you to get information about the spatial distributions. And of course, you can collect bees, you know, repeatedly from the same hive over time, so you can get changes over time as well. which is fantastic. So you get space and time.
Mark, I assume that we're talking about the European honeybee here as opposed to, say, the native bees.
Yes. I have looked at native bees for this purpose previously as well, and they do show very similar patterns, and that was Tetragrynolia carbonara. So we've used the native bees, but they have a much smaller footprint around their hives, about 500 metres.
Right.
And that's how far they forage. So if you needed a more detailed survey, native bees are better, but they're quite hard to find, the native beehives. Whereas if some people actually have them in their yard, and those are the ones that we use. Whereas, you know, European honeybees are much easier to identify. People have to register the beehive, and so you can engage with the beekeepers about, you know, what the project that you're doing, why it's important, and what you hope to find. And of course, they all ask the salient, the key question: is the honey safe to eat? That's the question, and we were really able to answer that. And and the answer is yes. Even if it's produced in cities, it's great. Even if it's produced near a smelter, it's still consumable. There's no risk of harm. But the bees give us an indication about what's going on in the environment.
I'm glad you said that, Mark, because I happened to stock up on some honey from down the peninsula today. So I'm looking forward to having a spoonful of it when I get home. But there is something that's concerning me out of this conversation is I'm thinking of the poor bees. If they're sucking up all the pollution that we're creating, and they've also got to deal with that varroa mite as well, don't they? I mean, aren't they under a lot of pressure?
The bees are under a lot of pressure, and you know, they're really at the front line of interfacing with the environment and all the chemicals that we've put out. Yeah, it's a human species. You know, we are effectively ourselves industrial species anyway. But bees live in the summer period about 4 weeks, and the final 2 weeks of their life is spent foraging. Now, there have been various studies that have looked at metals and the impact on bees, and it's pretty clear at certain thresholds of concentration. We didn't do this in our study, I add, but it's pretty clear, you know, elevated levels, it does interfere with the bees' capability of foraging, their efficacy doing that work. They're less efficient, they're less able to do the waggle downs, and we know that some of the metals that they can be exposed to, like lead, nickel, for example, cadmium, the neurotoxic metals, and it will interfere with the bees' capacity to communicate where the best food is that they found during foraging. But the effect of that will probably happen as the bees age, because it's pretty clear that the bees accumulate it over their lifespan. So those effects will occur as they move towards the end of their life, which is, you know, after about 4 weeks.
We're chatting with Mark Taylor, Chief Environmental Scientist at EPA Victoria, about two new studies that showed how bees are great at monitoring contamination in urban environments. Mark, bees aren't the only biomonitors out there, though, are they? What else can we use?
No, that's right. And at EPA, we've been using bees to try and understand the spatial distribution of contaminants, but we're also using birds. We're working with Max Gillings from Macquarie University to look at urban sparrows, because they're commensal with human species. They basically live in our homes where there's food, not on our gardens, that is. Mm-hmm. And also birds of prey. Others have used butterflies and worms. But through all of this work that we've done with biomonitoring, whether it's the work that we've done in Sydney that we've then brought down here, and we're looking at PFAS in bees, and this has been stimulated by one of our researchers, EPA Cara Fry.
That's the forever chemical, isn't it?
That's right. And we've had to go through a special process to get the appropriate detection limits for the measurement of PFAS. We were looking at pesticides and trace metals, but we're looking at across a range of species to understand which ones would be most suitable and why. Look, it is without question that, you know, we can measure and see most of the industrial chemicals that we're aware of through our daily news in the wider environment. I guess the question ultimately is, are they concentrations that present a risk of harm? And I think, you know, fortunately, in most cases and in most places, the answer is no. There are places where we know there's contamination, for example, around smelters or places, you know, industrial locations where there's a much greater risk of harm. But for the broader public and than the wider population? The answer is no, but we can still see that, you know, we can see an imprint of the differences between an urbanized area and a rural area.
Mark, what can we do at home in our households and our gardens to help the insects and the bees? What can we do at our level, the grassroots level?
Well, that's a great question. And look, I think the first thing, if you've got a garden at home, EPA Victoria has a program called Garden Safe. You can get your soils tested and find out whether they're suitable for gardening. We'll do, you know, nutrients along with trace metals. We'll give you some advice. So you can generate and create a garden which where plants and flowers and your food can flourish. That's the first thing. The second thing is you can think about creating or having keeping bees and creating habitat for all animals, because, you know, diversity is the key to make sure that our plants can be pollinated properly. Plants are not just pollinated by bees, they're pollinated by a whole range of insects. So that's one of the things that we can do. And the other one is to think about what we do with our waste, that we dispose of it in the correct way. We don't dispose of it carelessly in the wider environment, because all types of pollution are adverse to the environment and biota that use that environment. Never mind the aesthetics. I've just come back from a European trip to Italy, and I was amazed about the extent of litter in the capital, Rome. We don't have that, but we can still take actions to even reduce what litter we have, as an example. The same thing is about discharging our wastewater into, we don't discharge it into drains that go into streams. We discharge it in an appropriate way. For example, into the sewer system would be a much safer way, because it doesn't then interact with the environment. So washing car suds into the stormwater drain, which gets into the road, will have an adverse effect on our creek.
Because most of us wash our cars, you know, in the street, so we shouldn't be using the car suds?
Well, my advice is if you can, but wash it on a lawn, because it goes straight onto the lawn, saves you watering the lawn. But in the car, I mean, I just give car suds as an example, but, you know, that does get into the river system.
Of course.
That's the reality. It goes into the stormwater, which then goes into a local creek. And if it's full of, you know, if it's full of suds, that will have an adverse impact on the creek. It will use up the oxygen and may cause oxygen deficit in the creek, along with, you know, adding non-natural chemicals to the water system, as an example.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't ordinarily get a bucket of soapy water and just go and pour it in the street. Well, most people wouldn't. But that's effectively what happens. So I think it's about us being conscious about what we do and why we do it and what are the alternatives. So if you see a piece of litter, pick it up, stick it in the nearest bin. I've trained my kids to do that. We collect litter when we go out. And they're kind of quite appalled, you know, seeing the extent of litter on the side of a road. And then, you know, we will pick it up if we're out walking and put it in a bin.
I love that you do that. And it's something that I do when I walk my dog. But I would encourage everyone, when you see someone going around and picking up the litter, go up and thank them, because they're helping the environment for you.
Yeah, and I would say if everybody in Victoria can pick up one piece of litter a day and put it in a bin and dispose of it appropriately, that would be 6 million pieces of litter less in our environment every day. So multiply that by 365. That's a lot of pieces of litter, and we'd have a much cleaner environment, and less of that litter would be getting into the streams, which would not be getting into our bays, which would not be impacting the fish and the mammals that we find in our seas, which nobody wants to do.
No, definitely. And you've issued a challenge. We're all going to pick up one piece of litter today. Mark, great to chat with you again. Thanks for joining us on Joy Drive. I'm going to go and enjoy my pollution-free honey.
That's fantastic. You enjoy it and put it on your toast every day. It's really good for you. Carry on gardening. Enjoy the bees.
Thank you. That's Mark Taylor, Chief Environmental Scientist at EPA Victoria.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app, no matter where you are.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.